Good evening, friends. There's a bit of an art in listening to a Dharma talk. And we don't often talk about it. But I invite you to receive my words, my sharing, as an offering to let yourselves be touched by what resonates with you. And if pieces don't resonate, to just let it move through you. And it's different when we're together in a relational field like this, sharing in the Dhamma, sharing in the teachings, because it's so relational, and we really are creating a field of practice together. So being here, listening to, being present for a Dhamma talk is different than reading words on a page of a book. That's alive in a certain way. And I have ideas of what I will talk about, what I'll share with you this evening that I hope will be helpful to you as we approach the close of our first full day of this retreat. Yeah, but it's emergent. It's emergent from us together. And so you don't need to remember all the particulars of what I say. The talk is really a pointing to encourage you to keep practicing and to make contact with what you already know deep inside of yourselves. If you've sat a lot of retreats, you know that the first day of retreat really isn't that predictable. If you've sat a lot of retreats, you've maybe had the first day of retreat be, you know, a sense of walking uphill both ways, a sense of your body being a pain bag. Or maybe if you've sat a lot of retreats, you come in and you're just so glad to be away from your ordinary lives, and you just settle in to the space, the structure, the rhythm. I know when I sit a retreat, I never know quite how it's going to go. You know, there's times when life's humming along quite easily, and I expect retreat to be like that, but it's not. And there have been times that I've been through very difficult things and have come onto retreat and been surprised by the presence of peace that has been true for me in my experience. And if this is your first retreat, for 30-some of you, you will never have to make it through your first day of your first residential meditation retreat again. Congratulations. You are almost there. And you're all still here. No matter how much you might have planned your escape route, you're here. I came across a cartoon this afternoon, and it has a picture of a person meditating with three thought bubbles. And the thought bubble on the left says, "I love routine." Then, well, to you, it would be on this side. The thought bubble in the middle says, "Until I'm bored, then I love excitement." And then the third thought bubble says, "Until I'm overwhelmed, then I love routine." Have you been through this today, some? So, on this path, we often say that the core of the citta, I'll explain more about the word citta in a bit, the core of the citta, or the heart-mind, is brilliant sanity. In this statement, there's not a truth that what passes through is brilliant sanity. In the statement, the core of the heart mind, the core of the citta is brilliant sanity. It's not so much the neuroses that pass through, the worries that pass through, the content in any given moment, because that's so momentary. You know, the statement is pointing to the nature of awareness itself. The statement is pointing to how, in the practice, we make space for the brilliant sanity of our hearts to shine through, to know directly, to know experientially that you are more than your stuck places. To know directly that you are more than the hurt. You are more than the fear, more than the planning. More than whatever mind state may be present in any given moment. Brilliant sanity is has a measure of peace and compassion, a measure of a wisdom that doesn't arise from the thinking mind. Brilliant sanity is naturally responsive, clear. And part of what happens as the practice unfolds is that, you know, the waves of our experience, for the most part, it's not as if they stop, you know. The ocean is the ocean. But we become less identified. We become less hung up on the nature of any particular wave because we know, actually, that's not true. We become less hung up on, like, the particulars of a given wave because we know the nature of the wave. It's a bit paradoxical. We open to feel and know our experience more directly, and it becomes less sticky because we're not in contention quite so much. We just let waves do what they do. And so my awareness, your awareness, is awareness itself, it has the same nature. And at its core is brilliant sanity. So as the momentum of present moment awareness begins to grow, begins to build, begins to have a kind of power, an energy of its own, there's just an alchemical unfolding. It's not that straightforward because the beautiful states emerge, spaciousness and trust emerges, and so does all of our primary patterning. You know, so does all of the conditioning that shapes how we see ourselves, how we see the world, all the primary patterning that we project onto our story of me, and by virtue of that, my story of you. And in the practice, we're really saying this too, we're really making room over and over again. Because awareness can hold the moments, the realities, the raw vulnerability of how it is to live within the experience of a human heart. And so we're attuning, we're harmonizing, we're remembering. Remembering what? Remembering what matters. Remembering to be present. And as our practice unfolds, we're really opening to perceiving what we've been trained out of perceiving. Sure, there are times in meditation when we bring the attention to what we've been instructing, an anchor. We narrow the attention in a certain way, but in the big picture, we're really opening ourselves to more of life. And when we trust our capacity to be with more of life, there's just less fear. There's more ground. And so we're moving. As we practice, we're in a journey of moving from a thought-based reality. Think of Descartes, I think, therefore I am. That's like deep in a lot of our programming. That's a lot of what I learned when I was a student in most of the schools I went to. I learned to think, and I learned to develop arguments and defend them. All right, that's not the same as happiness. That's not the same as peace, is it? It's a certain orientation that elevates the rational mind, and the rational mind's important. There's so much more. So we're moving from a thought-based reality to a sense-based reality. We keep telling you to, inviting you to sense, notice, observe, feel. Maybe you can feel the mood in the room tonight. It's not the same as it was last night. Maybe you're feeling kind of resonances or energetic impressions from the day that are here in your body, here in the state of heart that's present as you listen to the talk. And so the whole path is one of, it was what Howie was pointing to last night about refuge. Moving from laying our heads down, putting our trust in a thought-based reality that might also be some measure of, you know, like, oh, the suffering is so much. You know how it feels to kind of reduce ourselves to our worst moments, to reduce ourselves to what's hard. I'm not diminishing the reality of what's hard, but there can be a way that we can almost worship it. It can limit our ideas of who and what we are. And so we're moving from laying our head down upon, you know, in the direction of that kind of altar to putting our hearts upon taking refuge in a deeper and wider mystery. At the core of the citta is brilliant sanity. We're letting ourselves rest in something that's actually trustworthy and that comes from the long process of conscious awareness. Bell Hooks says, contrary to what we may have been taught to think, unnecessary and unchosen suffering wounds us. And she speaks, it's like I can just hear her words speaking to us. Unchosen suffering wounds us, but need not scar us for life. It does mark us. What we allow the mark of our suffering to become is in our own hands. And this is the work of meditation. The suffering that we create for ourselves, the suffering that arises from our fundamental confusion, our fundamental delusion of separateness. How do we take this suffering into our own hands? Well, moment by moment. May I meet this moment with kindness. And for those of you who are new to retreat, it's natural to have a lot of doubt, like to work really hard to come on this retreat and then to get here and think, what the hell am I doing? Why am I here? Do I really have to do all of this sitting and walking to awaken? I think so. I don't know of another way. I don't know of an app that'll take you all the way there. Apps are great. But there's no substitute for this territory. It's like anything you practice. I think about when I learned to play the piano. You know, I didn't start playing a concerto. You know, you start with notes and scales and arpeggios and chords. And we practice. And just inviting a sense of patience with ourselves the same way we would approach riding a bike for the first time. It takes time. And if you're doubting the practice or yourself, you can really borrow some of my trust in the practice, because my trust in the practice is pretty firm. It doesn't shake so much. So if you're feeling those voices of doubt come round and round and round, you can draft off the whole teaching team a bit, because we have a lot of faith. We have a lot of faith in what brings us to be here. My first retreat, I hated it. I went on my first retreat when I was a full-time college student. I was putting myself through school. I was working really hard, and I was in school. I'd been practicing meditation for maybe 3 or 4 years before I did my first retreat. And the reason I sat a retreat is that there was this feeling like I couldn't sit still with myself. I was always going. Part of why I was going was, you know, just the fullness of my life and what I had to do to make it through. But there was this deep sense in me of something's not quite right if I can't sit still with myself. And I was born and raised in Fargo, North Dakota, like the movie. I have some good hot dish while we're here at IMS. I'm just joking. But I'm from Fargo, and I was raised Unitarian. So I was raised in this really wonderfully open fellowship. And we didn't meditate, really. We had good liberal political discussions. But we didn't, I didn't leave with a way of feeling like I really know how to navigate, like experientially kind of how to navigate the struggles in my life. And so I came to do this meditation retreat, and I remember saying to the teacher, you know, you keep talking about the end of suffering, but all I'm doing is suffering. Why should I stay here? Like, this is suffering. I'd like to go eat sushi and get on my road bike. Thank you. You know? And I said, I'm just suffering. Why should I be there? And she got in my face and pointed her finger at me, and she said, because it runs your life. She was talking about suffering. She said, you should be here because suffering is running your life and you're resistant to investigating it. That was a long time ago. That was 27 years ago. And so I finished the retreat. I didn't like the practice, but I loved the Dharma talks. Because in the Dharma talks, the teachers were saying things that just felt true in my bones. You know, the practice was hard, but what they were saying, just in a way much deeper than the words, it just made sense to me. And so I got done with the retreat. I called my mother while she was still alive. I told her about the butternut squash, white bean enchiladas, and how I mostly was thinking about the next meal. And she said, Erin, you'll never have to do that again. You did that once, you tried it, you'll never have to do that again. Well, I did a lot more of it because I got home. And that evening, after vowing I'm never going to do this again, there was just this little niggle inside of me, like something had happened in me. I was pierced in a certain way. And there really was no going back. You know, and so I thought maybe I will sit another retreat and spent years of my life practicing on retreat. And now what I notice is that some of my happiest moments are on retreat. You know, because that's a kind of happiness that doesn't come from repeatedly getting what I want. It doesn't come from one sense gratification after another, which can hover above the sense of dissatisfaction. Our potential for dissatisfaction as human beings is bottomless in a certain sense. You know, the happiness of the moments on retreat have to do with the peace and simplicity of awareness itself. The happiness of the moments of retreat have to do with an awareness that's not bound up in clinging. And there's a way that practicing on retreats kind of imbues the rest of my life with more happiness and aliveness and joy. I was spending the month of September, I practiced for the month over at the Forest Refuge next door. And I was coming off a very, very full time. One of those times working, getting on the plane, knowing one way or another I'm going to end up practicing at the Forest Refuge. And I remember walking into my room, and I've done a lot of practice at the FR. I really, really appreciate and love it there. And I walked into my room, and coming from the airplane and the busyness of the airport is just a sense of, oh, what a sweet, simple, small room, completely sufficient for my purposes. You know, gratitude. And by the end of the retreat, it was interesting because my heart had settled so much, the room just felt like a palace. It didn't feel like a simple little room. It felt like everything I could have ever wanted because there wasn't so much greed in the mind. You know, it's like just so much fulfillment, so much beauty in that way. So what is citta? What are we talking about with heart-mind? This is the third foundation of mindfulness. We mentioned, I think last night we mentioned the first foundation is mindfulness of the body. Breathing, palms resting, body sitting. The second foundation of mindfulness has to do with being mindful of that which is pleasant, unpleasant, and kind of neutral. It's called vedana. It's important because with the arising of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral tends to be what conditions and shapes the arising of greed or aversion or wisdom even, depending on our relationship to it. Body, vedana. The third foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of mind, which is what I'm talking about. And often we associate the word mind with the head, the word heart, you know, with the heart. And it's really not so separate. I'll say more about that in another talk. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of dhammas, or just a inquiry, mind investigation of how the teachings are showing themselves through our experience. And so citta includes our capacity to be aware. Citta includes our capacity to be aware of heart states, of kind of emotional, emotive dimensions, of resonances, energetic impressions. There can be an empathic sense that is part of the citta, just a very subjective sense. The citta is highly, highly impressionable, responsive, receives experiences. And as I speak about citta in this way, like you could just take a moment to sense mindfulness of mind or mindfulness of citta, like kind of you can just sense, like, how is it for you right now? Not the story you would tell somebody about how it is, but like, how is it for you just now? Is your hearing, sensing the body, seeing? Yeah, you might notice if the mind feels dull, if the heart feels tired, if there's interest, if there's a feeling of really being in yourself or your attention being more spread out through the room. When we tune into the citta, we know we're not boxes corded off from one another. We're really much more of a living, dynamic field together because my words impact you and your practices impact me. Here we are, all together. Which kind of cuts through the way that the normative culture can really elevate kind of individualized experience. We have our individual experiences, but there can be kind of this hyper-individualized way of perceiving, rooted in separateness. And sometimes it's helpful to know a thing by kind of knowing what it's not. These are a few words from Ajahn Suchito, who's been a very important teacher for me. Here's what he has to say. He says, through lack of the knowing that arises through mindful reference to citta, which is what I'm talking about, people lose themselves in what grabs attention or get stressed out. In both cases, they lose full contact with their awareness, even to the extent of not knowing that in that a steady basis is available. Therefore, we have rampant social and individual disease, anxiety, stress, and depression because our systems and cultures have lost touch with awareness and the ease that is its fundamental nature. Instead, the message is that happiness and success only come from chasing and acquiring what's out there. This agitates the citta. And the scenario out there is that as soon as you get and become something, then it's out of date, so you got to get a new one and develop more. This is the world of surface, of which the touch screen is the icon. Contact is instant, glassy, and lacking depth. You just bounce from one thing to the next. In this scenario, there's no inner home, just a center that remains swampy, hungry, and restless. Do you feel what he's saying? I really was touched by how he talked about experience being like the touch screen. You know how that is when you're not really in contact with yourself? I know for me, there's a pain in that. I'm aware of it when it happens, when I like get so busy, I'm not in contact as deeply. And that image of being like a touchscreen, I thought, that's really kind of how it feels. It feels skin deep. There's a superficiality, and this practice brings us to the core. This practice moves us from a habituated external orientation to knowing our own interiority, which is boundless. To knowing our own interiority, which is where all that we really seek ultimately resides. And Ajahn Sucitto is speaking to just the movement of bouncing around at the mercy of our desires and our preferences. And this is like, sometimes we really see it, right? It's unmistakable. And sometimes it's just like, it's only when it begins to soften that we see, oh, it's been like that. I've just been so in it. Sometimes we don't even know the fatigue or effort until it begins to soften. Just a sense of, oh, this is what clinging is. Wow. Because when we're looking externally, the message is that our happiness isn't here. It's in the future, it's in the future, it's in the future. And the image may seem satisfying, but the whole thing is that the message is that the happiness is not in the present moment, but the thing is that we've always been in the present moment. And the present moment is unfathomably precious. It's the only place that happiness and peace really live. Otherwise, it's a thought, it's an idea that we project into the future. And so in a sense, there is this suspended kind of state of reality. And so Ajahn Sucitto is pointing to this steady base that's available. It's like there's a ground that deepens and stabilizes over time as we open to the experience of awareness, as we attuned to the nature of awareness, as we lay our heads down, you know, again at an altar that is more trustworthy and real than our ideas. You know, it's amazing the power that thoughts have over us. You know, in the meditation, when you notice that moment of like, oh yeah, that in breath. You know, over and again, over and again, over and again. One teacher I work with, he's like a walk of shame. He said, don't make it a walk of shame coming back to the breathing. But just that sense of when we wake up out of the trance, you know, thoughts are so powerful. Thoughts that we know and then kind of like deeper thoughts that may not be as conscious, they're so powerful. They shape our lives. But when you look at a thought directly, what is it made of? Nothing. Nothing. It's empty. You know, there's movement, there's phenomena, but it's not actually made of anything. And we build our lives around this. So it's just so powerful to begin to see, oh, thought in its nature really isn't so different necessarily than a sound or a sensation or a moment of pleasant or unpleasant. Phenomena being known. And so we are here to live our lives as so much more than a touch screen, more than self-images. And, you know, the separate self lives on grabbing and rejecting, grasping and rejecting. And we're training, you know, the mind runs out when it doesn't know its own nature. We're training the mind to rest in itself, to rest in its nature, so that we can move, we can be together, we can move through our days, our practice periods, our relationships from a place of more immediacy. There's a lot more ease, actually. This is a poem from the first Free Women. It's not a translation, but it's an interpretation of the Therigatta, which are these awakened verses of these elder nuns from a very long time ago. This is called Upasama, calm. And in the poem, or the utterances, you know, the flood is used as kind of a metaphor for these, for greed, hatred, delusion, these difficult forces of mind. How do you cross the flood? You cross calmly, one step at a time, feeling for stones. How do you cross the flood, my heart? You cross calmly, one step at a time, or not at all. We cross calmly, one step at a time, or not at all. And I get the image of like a raccoon crossing a stream, the way the paws feel into the water and the rocks. Or maybe you've watched a bear cross a river. I have, and there's just such a somatic kind of intelligence, wakefulness, embodiment. The bear's not thinking about it too much, I don't think. The raccoon's not thinking about it too much, but there's a sensing. That's a little bit part of the flavor of the cheetah I'm pointing to. I mentioned last night that I've been on sabbatical. I started a sabbatical September 1st. It's for 8 months. This is the only retreat I'm teaching during the whole 8 months. It's wonderful to be here within my sabbatical, because I'm coming in from a place that's pretty depressurized. You know, no matter how much I love what I do, and I do love what I do, there can be a feeling of life being pre-lived when I look at my calendar and it's like all scheduled out for 3 years. You know that feeling? I mean, it could be in the present moment with all of it, but it's still like, oh, this is what I'm going to be doing. And on sabbatical, there's no calendar. So it's just this beautiful receptivity to the moment. And because I haven't been teaching, I haven't been really inside of a teacher identity at all. And it's been a really remarkable experience. The teacher role, the teacher identity does good things, and it's important. I've just really been in what I'm calling the extraordinary ordinariness of my own life, mostly at home in Durango, where I live in southwestern Colorado in the mountains. And some of that feeling of spaciousness and curiosity that's present for me is because I'm not having to be somebody at all. I'm not leading organizations for this period of time. This is the first time I've been in front of a room since August. That's a long time. And I've just been in this real curiosity of, like, what is my lived experience when I don't have to be somebody? I really love the Dhamma. I'm really curious about the moments of my life. I feel very, very available, like just in love with the ordinariness of my life. And you know, I'm sharing this with you because a number of things, but with regard to not being inside of a role, I invite that for you this week. You don't have to be somebody here. You don't have to be the one that moves perfectly through the meal line. If you're here with somebody you know, you don't even have to be that person to them here. In fact, I kind of hope you're not. It's such a load off. It's such a gift to give yourselves permission to not have to be somebody in particular. It's so beautiful because it creates space to know more of who you really are. So it's like if you feel yourself in this time just like going into that familiar constellation, put it down. Just take a breath, pause. Act like you don't know the person you came here with. See what remains. Because what remains is awareness. What remains is mystery. What remains may be a flavor of the sacred. What remains is your radiant heart. What remains is life living through you. Just put it down. In the sabbatical, it's been a time of very deep reflection for me. As in, what do I really care about? What matters to me now and in the remainder of my life? I've kind of been in this ongoing reflection that might have the flavor of what people do at, you know, when they turn 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, decade birthdays, or sometimes what we do when at the end of a year, around the time of the new year. Kind of like taking stock. And often in Buddhist practice, we reflect upon death. There's a word for it. It's called marana sati. Marana means death. Sati means mindfulness. We're teaching you sati. We're teaching you how to practice mindfulness or remembering. So it's like remembering that we're going to die. Remembering that what arises passes, marana sati. And often we don't reflect so much on birth, but both are really important in terms of holding, like situating, why are we here doing this? What are we doing? Why does it matter? And my sabbatical has this flavor of it as a daily reflection on birth and death. And I, you know, just invite you to remember, I'm telling you what you already know, but how easily the veils of delusion kind of keep us hovering above the truth of life and death. Because when we're in touch with the truth, there tends to be a real preciousness, and I am preaching to the choir, you know that, or you wouldn't be sitting in this room right now. But if you consider, you know, you've been born. There are so many of us on the planet. And in Buddhist cosmology, it's quite rare and precious to be born as a human being with the capacity to awaken. It's rare to be born to be here. And kind of between, you know, being born is a liminal space. It's a movement from one world to the other. Dying is another liminal space. It's a departure of one world into the great beyond. And retreat is a form of a liminal space. We're kind of between the worlds here. You know, and whether you're committed to Dharma practice or whether you're just checking it out, you're somewhat committed to be here this week, we are practicing a deeper way of living. And we're here because of the conditions that allow us to be here. Really, really quite remarkable because of conditions where otherwise we wouldn't be here. Think about all it took for you to actually be here. You know, besides getting online and registering and getting a spot. Besides sending in your deposit. Of all the beings at home, perhaps, that are supporting you in some way. To be here. And there can be a sense, as we consider the conditions of our birth and our lives, there can be a sense that our lives are not exactly of our own making. One friend puts it this way: I've been thrown into a world that was not of my own making. We're born into our lives differently, right? We're situated in different histories, families and societies that aren't directly of our own choosing. So we're kind of thrown into our lives in a certain way that aren't of our own making, but that are ours to navigate. As we so often say on this path, like, you can't do it alone. like Howie and Victoria were talking about last night. You can't do it alone, but nobody can do it for you. Our lives are ours to navigate. How do you cross the flood? You cross calmly, one step at a time, or not at all. So, in practice, we are learning how to navigate our lives, and we're making contact with our own depth. We're making contact with our own interiority, the citta that I'm speaking about, the core of which is brilliant sanity, is kind of like the depths of the ocean. Being the icon is just like taking ourselves to be the very surface of the waves when there is a deep, dynamic, living sea far, far beneath. And for each of us, you know, we know that our death is certain and that the timing of our death is uncertain. Do you know anybody who's come before you who hasn't, like, do you know any living being who, we'll just say it, every living being who's come before us has died. You know, nobody here is an exception to this. We will be parted from everything we hold dear. And what's the most, what's the greatest cause of death? Birth. So how do you want to live? If there wasn't going to be another in-breath as of tomorrow afternoon, would you be interested in the next breath? If there wasn't going to be another step, would you be interested in the 40th step of your walking meditation practice? So it just begs this question, right? Mary Oliver, what is it you plan to do with this one wild and precious life? And for me, I do not know a better practice for living or for dying than Dhamma practice. And this week is your life. It's not a mistake. Exactly what's happening now is your retreat. Don't miss it. It's not supposed to be going differently. Deepa Ma is a teacher whose just presence and kind of realization has been so powerful in my own life. Many years ago, a lot of years ago, I was going through a dull time in my practice, and somebody said, "Erin, you should go to India, go hang out with a saint." And I said, "I can't go to India. I can't just walk away and go to India." And so I didn't go to India to hang out with any saints, but I started like kind of praying in a certain way, like, who do I need to be connecting with? Like, how do I juice up my practice here? And it was Deepa Ma. It was this incredible. Deepa Ma was a householder, a mother, who had sustained so much loss and had profound realization. Just used her life in such a beautiful way. And she says, there's nothing to be clung to in this world. Ask yourself, what can I take with me when I die? What can I take with me when I die? Because in a very real sense, all we have are these, when things are really stripped down, what we have is the energy of what we've practiced. And what we have is the energy of, you know, you see people who go through very difficult diagnoses and conditions, who may not really be able to think at all, the quality of their hearts still come through. You know, what we have is the citta. The citta is still there. And I know my own mother, at the end of her life, yeah, I've been doing what I do for a long time. It's like 8 weeks before she died, she said, "Hey, Erin, my doctor is talking to me about mindfulness, and I realized you might know something about this." Like, you think, Mom. It was like at the very end of her life, she started getting interested in practice. And we don't have to wait. It's so beautiful. We are here now. This incredible opportunity to practice wholeheartedly, because we are alive and we are in between birth and death. And harmonizing with, opening to the brilliant sanity at the core of the citta, you know, we give you pointers, we talk about the lists, all these frameworks. It's very experiential, it's very personal. And you don't even have to always be present, because nobody is. It just, you know, just ask yourselves, am I willing to be present? Just the willingness. At the end of my mother's life, I was with her. I was with her as she was in hospice and spent a long time by her bedside in a very difficult time. And she was in North Dakota. And I remember one morning just kind of asking, like, what kind of presence is needed here now to help us find our way through this? And the image of Thich Nhat Hanh and just the energy of what he embodied came to me so clearly. And so I was sitting with her. I was sitting with her day after day, just kind of invoking Thich Nhat Hanh's presence and his energy and his, his massively compassionate, equanimous being. I was sitting doing this visualization. Of course, I didn't tell her I was doing that. And she started, she's, you know, on morphine, kind of in and out in her dying process. And she started this thing where she started saying, hello, hello. And I said, Mom, who's there? And she said, they're calling me. And I said, who's calling you? And she said, a new friend. And I said, who's your new friend? She said, it's a Vietnamese man. Really? I hadn't told her a thing, you know? So it's like at the core of the citta is brilliant sanity. At the core of the citta is incredible mystery, profound sensitivity, remarkable capacity for attunement and connectedness. And what we do here, the way we're practicing, you know, the way we're spending our time, it matters. It matters for life and death. And we learn to pay attention to the silence between the words, the space between the words, the sounds. We notice what remains. Maybe you can feel that now. The thundering, wakeful, knowing, often ineffable kind of presence. And we don't have to go looking too far for it. It's like looking for a key that's in your pocket. It's like trying to find your glasses when they're on your head. We just open to this moment, here and now. I'll close with a poem by Lisa Shatsky from When Colors Run. It's called What Matters. What matters is that you do not pretend, you do not hear the water's ancient melody over stones in the river. And you do not turn away from the questions ringing inside you like bells in monk's hands. What matters is that you do not ignore the alpine meadows and their wildflowers singing the cobalt sky. And you say yes to the laughter and yes to the tears. And you open yourself up to the mountains so the sun can find you and the wind caress your face and the grass kiss your feet. What matters is that you say yes to the dance and yes to the songs and yes to the night and all her stars. Yes to the colors painted by light and yes to the deserts and their longings for soul. What matters is that you say yes to the voice inside, the voice of the one you forgot, the one who dreamed and played and loved. And you bring forth what is in you to bring forth, and you break through your own walls and erase your own ceilings and stumble and fall and get up again as you find your way home. So we'll just pause for a moment to let the words settle, just right where you are. Thank you for your kind attention this evening. We'll come back for the last sitting at 8:45.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.